This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
Federal immigration agents suspected of criminal wrongdoing could face charges from the Cook County State's attorney after she unveiled a policy to prosecute them.
Indiana taking another step today toward trying to bring that team to Hammond.
It was a surprise to us. We completed more than 3 hours, my team did, of discussions with the Bears. Very positive discussions.
Chicago's city council failed to install a permanent zoning chair yesterday.
A hemp still on shelves here in Chicago. Council tried to ban most of it, but they didn't have the votes to override the mayor.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget address laid out a $56 billion spending plan for a year that's marked by dwindling federal funding support. Chicago City Council members tried and failed to override Mayor Johnson's veto of a ban on some hemp products. Plus, tributes and reflections continue to pour in for Chicago icon and global civil rights leader Jesse Jackson.
America will get better and better. Keep hope alive.
Civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. died this morning. He was 84. Jackson's career was centered here in Chicago.
In his annual budget address, Pritzker talked about the concern that social media is harming kids' physical and mental health.
When Donald Trump is taking resources away that are rightfully ours, none of us, Democrats or Republicans, should be okay with that.
A wild scene along the windy lakefront today. First responders say two people were blown into the water and rescued by witnesses. One of the victims, a baby girl.
We'll get into those stories and much more. But let's start today's episode with a closer look at an upcoming series that's going to be in both the Sun-Times and WBEZ. With me to discuss is WBEZ senior editor Alden Lowry. He is also one of our panelists this week. Hey, Alden.
Hey, Sasha.
Good to see you.
Same here.
So you've been working with your Chicago Public Media colleagues on this in-depth look, I hear, into the history of the Black church here in Chicago.
Yes, our data fellow, investigative fellow, Nicole Janine Johnson, proposed the series to me when she first started with us back in November, and I was really captivated by it, essentially just kind of walking through history, some of the major contributions that the Black church has made to Chicago, specifically to the Black community here. And so it's going to be eight stories in all. And so the first three are really going to kind of document the history of the Black church. The fourth piece will look at kind of the future of the Black church. Where are things now? Where are we headed? And then the last four pieces, we're going to focus on one or two in each episode, one or two churches that are doing work right now in the areas of education, social justice, housing, and economy/finance.
And for the person listening who still doesn't get it, I mean, the Black church is integral to this city. I mean, it played such an important role in the Underground Railroad movement of the 1800s. Let's just start there, right?
Sure, yeah. And in the first episode, we will document the contributions of the very first Black church established in Chicago in 1844, and how very quickly the members of that church were very active participants, conductors, if you will, in the Underground Railroad. So we'll document some of that history and get into a little bit about the impact and that as an example of just how integral the church is in the lives of Black folks here.
Fascinating. We look forward to checking it out once it's published. Now, why don't we just jump into the full recap? Thank you for stopping by, Alden.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Simone Alisea, executive producer of CityCast Chicago, the daily podcast and newsletter, and Christian Farr, reporter for NBC5 Chicago. Now, first things first, Governor Pritzker unveiled the state's proposed budget on Wednesday during his State of the State address before the Illinois House and Senate. Pritzker proposed a new tax on social media companies, which he estimates would bring in $200 million in revenue. Here's Alden with more on how that would work.
So it's a pretty much a staggered kind of scale. Social media companies are going to be taxed per level of their users, for the smaller outfits that are getting less than 500,000. I think it's 10 cents per user. For a half a million to a million users, they're getting taxed $40,000 a month plus a quarter every user. And then for the big boys and girls, those platforms would be charged $165,000 a month. These are folks who are getting a million users in Illinois. $165,000 a month plus an additional 50 cents for every user over a million.
Yeah.
So, like you said, about $200 million are expecting in revenue from this new tax.
Yeah, he said, as big tech companies continue to profit off of surveilling youth and creating addictive algorithms. And
he leaned into those companies.
Responsibility for kids online.
Yeah, their impact on young people.
Right, yeah. Right. How did lawmakers respond to that social media tax?
I think somewhat of a mixed bag. On some levels, this is kind of a new thing, a new way in which I think Mayor Johnson had proposed something similar to this at the city level. This is a new way to get revenue. Governments are getting more creative and trying to find ways to generate revenue. But some pushback just in terms of another tax on business, and Illinois being considered a high tax state, and that impact on business development is always a criticism when something new pops up like this.
Yeah, that social media tax, it's something that, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson also proposed in his city budget last fall. He wanted to bring in revenue for mental health services specifically. The controversial measure was retained in that alternate budget that ultimately got approved by city council members, and tech companies are vowing to challenge that move in court. Now, that was not the end to the hits that social media took in the governor's speech. What was it, Alden? What else is he proposing?
No, he's also trying to, speaking to his sentiment around the impact that social media has on young people, the damaging impact and potentially, having guardrails in terms of how young people can interact with social media. So essentially stopping nighttime notifications and then also increasing the ability that parents have to control the flow or the interactivity that their children have with social media. Those are a couple things in particular that were highlighted during the address.
Yeah. Well, the governor is also trying again to enact a ban on cell phones in classrooms, Christian. He tried this before, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And this is because of research that has been put out there for a very long period of time. But yeah, he's backing this new proposal that goes a little bit farther than before. I mean, he wants to limit tablets, smartwatches, laptops, gaming devices on school grounds throughout the entire school day. And I remember a couple of years ago, we went to Evanston Township High School, actually the community I live in, and they have taken these cell phones out of the classroom, which is sort of the original point of all this, is that when kids are switching between classes, they enter the classroom, there is something there where they can stash their cell phones there and don't have access to them throughout the day. But I mean, this is something that there has been a lot of Pew research on concerning that a high number of high school teachers have been concerned about cell phones being a distraction in the classroom.
So they were already creating their own policies.
Right. And a lot of schools have already done this. I mean, we did a story a couple of months ago on a cell phone challenge where a small group of 13-year-old young women gave up their cell phones and gave them to the principal. And he locked them away for 1 week. And then they took part in a podcast and talked about what the impact was. And they had more time to do things. They had more time to study, more time to get sleep. They didn't have these notifications going on all night. So there seems to be a lot of support for doing this. But I mean, there's also a question about being able to use this for emergencies. I mean, this is something back in my day, I didn't have a cell phone.
That's right.
So your parents had to wait to get in touch with you, being able to have that connectivity for emergencies or appointments or things of that nature. So we'll just have to see which way this goes if we're going to get really, really extreme.
Yeah, I've talked about it several times on the show. I'm on both sides of the fence. I'm the mom who wants to reach her kid, but also, like you, Christian, grew up where mom and dad sent me to school, and they just knew that I was fine for the whole day. And then I miraculously showed up at, you know, after 3 p.m. back home, and, you know, it wasn't a huge deal. So interesting to see how that's unfolded. Now, the Governor Simone has also called for this 2-year pause on data center tax credits, which surprised me because weren't we team data center
he
here?
He certainly was in 2019, right? That when he proposed and pushed forward these tax incentives.
So what's this about?
So I think what the governor is responding to is there is just a lot of local pushback, particularly to new what are sometimes referred to as hyperscale data centers, AI data centers, right? AI needs a lot more computing power than your regular computers do, and they're trying to build data centers to compete. And we've seen communities around Illinois really debate whether they already have a data center in their community and there's issues with noise or you know, energy or pollution, whatever the case might be, or if there is a data center that is being considered in that community. And so I think the governor is sort of seeing the tide kind of turn on public opinion, again, even within the communities that theoretically benefit from these data centers and the jobs they create and things like that. And is sort of saying, okay, let's take a pause on these tax incentives. Maybe let's not say everybody come to Illinois. We already have a bunch of data centers. Maybe we don't need to be moving quite so fast on building these really big ones.
So there's a concern that pausing the tax incentives could lead to data centers not investing in our state.
Yeah, I mean that, and of course the data center industry says that, you know, you're selling yourself out of, you know, a bunch of jobs and of course new revenue. But again, I think you know, there are, this has been such a debate both on a couple different angles. Again, you have the environmental angle. You also have just like our energy costs.
Right.
Like, right. ComEd has already said that I think a lot of us have experienced our rates going up in the past year. And the
water usage too.
Water usage is a concern.
Big concern.
And, you know, I think it's the other thing too to keep in mind is that some of these tech companies have already been avoiding Illinois because they're also concerned with our biometric security law. And so they're, you know, opting to build some of these data centers in Indiana and Wisconsin. But again, it's also important to know Illinois already has quite a lot. We have, I think, over 200.
Yeah, we're a tech hub, right? That's a huge priority for Pritzker.
Yeah, and I think there's a big difference, too, between like data centers, which again are these big entities that when they're the permanent jobs they employ are actually not that many. Most of the jobs come from the construction of these data centers, which again, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at. But, you know, it's different from a tech hub in the sense that like we have a bunch of people developing the next Uber, the next Google, the next, you know, those are kind of two different things when we talk about being a tech hub.
I see. Yeah. Sticking with you, Simone, and this governor budget address. I mean, do you think overall, I'm sure you listened to or watched the 50 minutes. Were his policy priorities clearly laid out to you?
You know, I would say that this, I think yes and no. I think, you know, there's a, this budget address, and I think other people have referred to it as this, is much more of a status quo budget. I think, you know, obviously we have so much uncertainty given what is happening at the federal level. And he certainly spoke to that, right? Of just the way that the Trump administration has threatened actual dollars, you know, coming into Illinois and sort of needing to kind of balance that threat with balancing the actual budget and making sure we're not cutting a bunch of services. You know, I think this, it's interesting because I think this sort of tech, this element of tech is kind of the thing that has emerged as the most prominent between the data centers, the social media, the cell phone ban, and sort of what effect does it have on Illinoisans. And I think is sort of an interesting positioning coming from him.
Because everything else, Alden, was really just criticizing the Trump administration, I think, right?
That certainly has become a theme with the governor. And some people like it. Some people have been very critical of the governor about this. But the address was...
Although not as fiery as last year's.
No. He likened, we heard
lots of
Nazi
one-liners.
Germany references. It was pretty bad last year, but still, he still was making his points. I mean, he talked about the weakness of hate and just a lot of very strong overtures and criticisms of the way the president has governed. And then he did talk about the direct impact that it's having on Illinois, speaking to the tune of $8 billion of budgetary of the budget that is uncertain because there are dollars that are meant for the state, but the president has challenged them.
Right.
Some of those things have been hung up in court, from SNAP benefits to child care to a number of different things. So administrative costs that the state is now assuming, I think $100 million is one number that was thrown out that the Illinois now has to pay given some of the changes from the administration. So the governor has definitely taken his every opportunity to
jab.
Yes,
absolutely. What kind of reaction overall did he get from his speech, like from lawmakers?
So it's interesting. So, of course, the Democrats were generally agreeable, although there was some, I would say some of the more left-leaning members of the party wanted other kinds of revenue-generating things. It was a tax on billionaires or a couple other things that they were hoping to get that did not come out in this particular budget proposal. And then, of course, on the other side of the aisle, a lot of criticisms about Kathy Salvia, the GOP chair, I think, talked about, empty promises.
Yeah, and she said today's speech from J.B. Pritzker was nothing more than empty promises, hypocrisy, and fear-mongering.
Right. And there was another piece from the House Minority Leader, Representative McCombie, who talked about essentially this was, we don't need another, Illinois doesn't need another essentially campaign speech. So so this theme of the governor who was perhaps expected to be running for president, although it seems pretty clear that this is something that
that's
he wants
where we're
to
heading.
Do.
These are the primers that are happening right now.
Yes. There seem to be some echoes of Lincoln calling on people to respond to the, quote, better angels of our nature. In how Pritzker ended his budget address, saying, you know, that even as the Trump administration sows chaos in Illinois, America still loves its people back.
And it turns out that love actually is all around, and that those who think that cruelty can destroy us are incapable of understanding the power of a nation moved by it. I love my country. I refuse to stop. The hope I have found in a very difficult year is that love is the light that gets you through a long night.
So Christian and Simone, just kind of piggybacking off of what we just touched on, I mean, people are wondering if he's eyeing this run for the White House. Tell me more about what you think and whether, you know, this ending the speech on love, does it sound like a budget address or is this
like
a campaign
speech?
It sounds
like the Bad Bunny halftime show. That's what it sounds like, to
Who
me.
Who didn't watch the Bad Bunny halftime show?
I mean, yeah, I think like, you know, for somebody who has been named as a potential presidential candidate, you know, in 2020, any speech he gives is a potential campaign speech. That just kind of is how it is. You know, it's so interesting. Every time the topic of Pritzker as a presidential candidate comes up, I just am always asking myself the question, is this only a thing we talk about here in Chicago? Is anyone else talking about this right now?
Yeah, I think I scratch my head and wonder, are people outside of Illinois talking about him? But I've got family outside of Illinois, and they are. They are. Mm-hmm. His name comes up. Gavin Newsom's name comes up. These are the names that kind of constantly come up over and over and over again. So, I mean, even his reaction to the Bears in Indiana, you know, a very strong stance, you know. So I think, yeah, he's prepping himself for it.
And I think the president's also kind of thinking about Pritzker and Newsom. When you look at the states that he's very, I would say, deliberately taken aim at, California, Illinois, Minnesota now appears to be in his crosshairs as well. So I think people are noticing. But, yeah, in terms of on the ground, I don't know if Pritzker's name necessarily is one that people are talking about. But yeah, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
It feels to me like the worst kept secret. Before we close out this statewide politics part of our conversation, it does seem every week, Simone, that a new lawsuit comes up against the federal government. So give us the latest on a lawsuit from Attorney General Kwame Raoul that he's filing.
Yeah, I mean, pick a topic, pick a department, and we've got a lawsuit. This one is been filed to try to halt cuts to federal energy and infrastructure cuts. And so these are grants that have gone to, organizations in Illinois that deal with, trying to make the grid more reliable, reduce emissions, and who are trying to find ways to use domestic sources of elements. According to the lawsuit, it's about $20 million in grants that are being threatened here in Illinois. This is just, as you say, one in a long string. You know, recently a judge blocked cuts to public health grants, mm-hmm. an appeals court restored medical research funding, and also released funding on disaster relief and transportation that had been threatened, right, that we have talked about at various points. And this is sort of another in that long string. And,
yeah.
you know, I think I actually also think the legal argument is interesting here, too, because basically Raul and these other states are saying that the Department of Energy, by issuing a memorandum to create like a review of these grants, that they're essentially end running around Congress's power of the purse, right? Congress allocated this money, therefore the money needs to be dispersed. Mm. And so that is kind of the argument these states are making.
Interesting. Kwame Raoul is very, very busy. I want to bring the conversation over to City Hall now, where alders were in session Wednesday. And Christian, last Friday, so a week ago, the mayor chose to veto that ordinance banning intoxicating hemp products. So where are we now with that?
Well, we were waiting to see if that was going to happen because there was an initial vote, which I believe was 32-16, to mm-hmm. pass this, but not enough to avoid that veto. So when they tried to override it, that vote ended up being 26-20. So they weren't even close to being able to override that veto. And really the issue that the mayor had and many of the alders had was that this was also impacting small businesses. One of them that we interviewed, Covington's Cabinet, that sells a lot of hemp-derived products mm-hmm. That are not intoxicating to children, which is where sort of the main issue with hemp is. It's these products that are sold over the counter that kids can get their hands on. And everybody wants to protect those children, but they thought this went a little too far and impacted those businesses. It would have shut down a lot. And then there's the whole federal discussion about hemp as well. So these companies, these small businesses were concerned that they would have to shut down
right.
Now that this ordinance was in place.
Yeah. I mean, Simone, do you expect that we will hear more about this issue? I mean, as Christian kind of alluded to there, there's a federal yeah. a federal case here, too.
I absolutely think this is something that we are going to hear more about because I think it is sort of this like very thorny policy issue that has all these moving parts. And then, of course, like complicating everything on top of that is also our legal weed legislation. So you have this kind of, intoxicating product that kind of exists in this weird gray area loophole, but businesses that are relying on it for their income. And, you know, no politician wants to hurt local businesses, but also no politician wants kids to get hurt. And
right.
so it's absolutely something we're going to be hearing more about.
Sure. Chicago City Council also failed to install a permanent zoning chair yesterday at Alden. Now, the zoning committee is one of the most important. Just talk broadly just about how this is impacting development here in Chicago.
I think I wouldn't say that it's ground to a halt, but it certainly just kind of slowed that process some.
It seems to be a holdup.
The zoning committee is kind of the entry point for a lot of changes with regard to development, a lot of proposals, so on and so forth. Really, things kind of get started there. For that reason, it is, I would say, probably one of the two most powerful positions to have in city government. Some of the holdup may be the mayor just trying to figure out maybe who he might want in that role. Mm-hmm. But very important for that reason. A lot of very important decisions affecting, you know, the size of developments, what can come in, what can come out. You know, Chicago's automatic prerogative is very much at play during zoning committee decisions and full council decisions related to zoning. So, yeah, this is a very important part of the city government.
And something you've been looking closely at, and especially how it would impact majority Black communities.
Yeah, so I wrote something recently just kind of focusing on the loss of Black population in the city over the last 4.5 decades or so and how that is tied in some ways to just the availability of housing units. You know, they're down in Black communities the way they aren't down anywhere else. The level of vacancies are higher in those communities as mm-hmm. well. We're just not building there, and we're not building enough there. And we're also tearing down more things in those communities as well. So proposals, so just pushing for more kind of housing proposals to kind of help increase the infrastructure for population to sustain mm-hmm. and to grow in those communities. And the zoning committee, a well-functioning zoning committee, and one that kind of has its eye on that particular aspect of growth and development is very necessary in order for things to turn around in those communities.
I want to take a look at another ordinance that kind of went nowhere on Wednesday, Simone. This is that measure that would have deputized Chicagoans to help enforce traffic violations or snitch
yeah, it's
on
a
other Chicagoans.
Legalized snitching.
So what was this about, and where'd it go?
So, you know, this is a really big issue in Chicago, where you have, you know, trucks or cars that are illegally parked in bike lanes and bus only lanes and things like that. And, you know, the city is already piloting a pilot program that put like mounted cameras on buses to document these violations and, you know, give those illegal parkers, you know, a ticket. And this ordinance was basically another step further in that, where the idea was, if you, Sasha, were walking down the street and you saw a car illegally parked in a bike lane, you could snap a picture, send it to 311 and be like, hey, you need to give this person a ticket, and maybe that person would get a ticket.
Right.
It died, I think, because of this idea, again, because it is legalized snitching. I think the idea of deputizing the average Chicagoan into enforcement didn't really sit well with a lot of people. I think the sponsor of the ordinance, I think it was Alder Daniel Espada,
yes.
You know, sort of tried to say, like, well, we need some kind of enforcement. Like, the enforcement of this, the problem here is that, yes, we know it's illegal, yes, we know that people can get tickets, but how do we actually enforce this when it happens? And, you know, spoke to the death of a young girl mm-hmm. because of a truck that was parked.
Yeah, I remember that.
Double parker in the lane. Yeah. And it was
but
sort
Alderman
of like,
rejected this, right? 31-16.
I think that's the trick with this. It's like, cameras are one thing. Like, we're maybe okay with being surveilled by technology. I think being surveilled by our neighbors is maybe where we draw the line.
That can get a little tricky.
Yeah.
You know,
I found the whole thing fascinating because I didn't think there was any problems at all in enforcing. I mean, I'm getting a ticket in the mail every other week. So right. It's like, you know, I think we're doing a pretty good job. The other interesting thing is that there are some ways in which people are already able to snitch. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't, you can report people who don't have a valid city sticker. You can report.
You can?
Yes. 311, there's a 311 category.
Well,
can't
you just report anything to 311? Like, even without this ordinance, can you just, like, report anything that is illegal to 311?
You can report building violations. You can report if people aren't clearing snow off their sidewalk, which can lead to fines. So,
but these aldermen drew the line at this.
Interesting. This was stepping over the
bounds. Well, I can also think, too, like, especially with the proliferation of Uber and delivery and stuff, like, you know, on some streets, it's sort of like, well, where do you put your car? Like, if you need to do this thing, where do you do it? And I know that, like, restaurants and sort of have called for, like, more signage and more clarity around where drivers can and cannot stop. But yeah, I think it's
I think the impact on the businesses was the thing that the alderman mostly zeroed in on about why they didn't want to do this. And then this, La Spada is closely plugged into the biking community. Mm-hmm. The biking community here is very
for
active.
Sure. Very strong. Yeah. Very strong.
Simone, you were talking about bike lane battles recently on CityCast Chicago. Fill us in.
Yeah, and this stems from some reporting that Block Club Chicago did in the 12th Ward, where bike lanes have become a really, really hot button issue. There has been construction underway on Archer Avenue to put in addition to bike lanes, other street safety improvements. And it has become so contentious that it has sort of already launched the aldermanic race in that ward, a candidate who has sort of come out and her main platform being that she's anti-bike lane. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's like, we're not against cyclists, but we don't like this plan. And, you know, it is interesting because I think there is this sort of tension when you have bike lanes that come up, because, like, ultimately, yes, the street is changing. The flow of traffic is going to change and there might be less parking. Traffic might be slower if you're a driver, but also they are sort of fundamental when you consider the safety of cyclists and you consider the safety of pedestrians. Archer Avenue has some of the highest, traffic fatalities and traffic crash rates in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a really, really dangerous street for pedestrians walking around on. And, like, you can see why a lot of folks in the neighborhood do want these, protections. So I think it's going to be a really interesting, aldermanic race in that ward.
Yeah. The city council considered another proposed ordinance, a measure that would have given Chicago's police oversight agency the power to investigate whether officers are violating Chicago's welcoming city ordinance. What are the details of that, Alden?
Yeah, so this was an idea to essentially kind of keep or allowing COPA to investigate police officers that, were alleged to have helped immigration agents. And this topic has actually been a thing, even, I would say, early in
2025, there were a couple of aldermen who had actually proposed an ordinance that, thanks to a parliamentary maneuver, never actually got to the floor, I believe. It was Alderman Lopez, Alderman Tavares, essentially, which would have given some space for Chicago police officers to actually aid immigration enforcement. And then, of course, we said we had, that never got there, and then we had the Midway Blitz. And so there's this concern about just making sure that there are rails, and if somebody does step over that, over those boundaries, that they are disciplined.
So this vote was blocked despite Superintendent Larry Snelling supporting it?
Yeah, so the superintendent is in favor of making sure that officers are not aiding immigration enforcement.
Okay.
It's like, you know, they have a job and a duty to the citizens of Chicago to protect them. And the federal government is in the business of immigration enforcement. There are some, you know, some pathways where there is a connection. If there's a judicial warrant presented, Chicago police have someone in custody that there's a judicial warrant related to their immigration status,
mm-hmm.
and they'll turn that person over. But beyond that, they're CPD is not a branch of the federal government's immigration enforcement. So there were some conservative alders who were essentially trying to make sure that there would be to prevent this ability for a COPA to investigate police officers from not reaching the floor.
I see.
But the superintendent has spoken to supporting something that would, you know, prevent cops from doing that.
And federal immigration agents could return to Chicago. Aren't we expecting them? I think March was the...
That's kind of the last
we heard, mm-hmm. right? I mean, do you think this ordinance will continue to be debated then?
I think it absolutely will. And, you know, I think, right, it's interesting because I think this particular ordinance giving the police oversight agency the authority to oversee whether the police are doing what they're supposed to do or not. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. It feels pretty common sense to me. That is what you imagine COPA's job to be. And so,
right.
I'm not sure what changes specifically, alders who are opposed to it are looking for here. But I have to imagine, you know, if we see anything like, you know, we got a taste of it with Operation Midway Blitz. Then we saw what happened in Minneapolis, which was just, you know, 10 times worse, 100 times worse. If we get anything on that scale here in Chicago, I think all eyes are going to be on not only the police, but of course the city government at large of, you know, just how exactly is the city protecting residents? And how are we holding accountable if we have this ordinance and a law on the books that says Chicago police cannot collude with, you know, work with immigration agents? How is that being enforced? How are we actually holding that to account?
Yeah. Cook County's state's attorney, Eileen O'Neill Burke, unveiled new guidance Thursday, Christian. This is for prosecuting the alleged crimes of federal immigration agents. What is she proposing?
Yeah, this is the first official policy from her office, which will hopefully be able to hold immigration agents accountable for doing anything sort of outside of what maybe their policies have been set forth. So, you know, we saw with Operation Midway Blitz, which was just a taste, like Simone said, of mm-hmm. what happened in Minneapolis. And I just came back from Minneapolis and that those communities are still shaken by what happened there. What they want to do is to be able to say to those officers, even though they do have immunity while they're doing their jobs, but if they do something that's so egregious that they could not have reasonably believed that it was in accordance with their official duties, that's what they want to be able to charge them with possible crimes while doing that enforcement. And, you know, we saw two people who died in Minneapolis while that enforcement was going on. And so they want to be able to have some policy here that they can move forward with to charge those agents if they do something outside of really what their official duties are. So we'll have to see exactly what the next steps with this. If we see another upsurge of agents coming back here and we see, you know, Operation Midway Blitz 2 come back
right
here to Chicago.
Which I think we will. I think we will. Yesterday, an Indiana House committee unanimously approved to advance legislation creating a Northwest Indiana Stadium Authority. So that would have the power to issue bonds, to acquire land, and finance construction. So I want to get all your thoughts on how significant this is, because it seems to me like we're seeing this pendulum swing to Indiana. Christian?
Yeah.
I feel like this is all just a giant stage play, to be honest.
I wouldn't discount it. I mean, look, I'm an East Coast kid, and
okay.
I grew up right outside of Philadelphia. My family's from Jersey. The New York Giants and the New York Jets both play in Jersey, and they're New York teams. So I don't think you should just erase this completely. I think it's a complete possibility. I mean, you can make it to Indiana to see the Chicago Bears. So, you know, they were taking a long time to wait to see what's going to happen in Illinois. And the governor didn't seem too happy about this. You know, we're having conversations. And then the next day you put out a statement that kind of says this is the biggest step in getting a new stadium for us. So, I mean, I think that's a big deal from the Bears, but you know, what is this?
But also,
you know,
it's not the first time the Bears have said, this is what we're focused on.
That is true.
Right?
That
like,
is true.
How many times have they flip-flopped between Soldier Field and Arlington? And again, the thing that I keep coming back to is they have purchased the land. Mm-hmm. They
that
own
is
it in Arlington Heights. Mm-hmm. What is happening in Indiana is essentially recreating what is the case here at Soldier Field, which is, hey, we're going to build this stadium authority that's going to give you all these benefits to tax incentive, but you're still going to rent it from us. Why would you go into another rental agreement with another state when you own property?
I mean, the whiplash for someone like me reporting on this, you know, on a daily show, I'm pretty sure just a few days ago, I sounded pretty certain when it comes to Arlington Heights. And then yesterday, boom. Yeah. Hammond, Indiana is the place to be.
This is another potential leverage point for the Bears to perhaps get what they really want, which is some of the infrastructure and the financial resources to develop the property that they've already purchased. And that would be my guess as to all of this. But the fact that it has happened, though, does... There's a real weight for that because it does increase their leverage. As long as the possibility of Indiana seems real to the governor, to people of Illinois, I think the governor's loosened up a little bit in terms of what the state might be willing to do from where he was maybe 6 months ago.
Oh, okay.
So
I think it would be more interesting if Illinois called the Bears bluff. Is sort of or like. You know what I mean? I think it would make whether or not they would go back and then move to Indiana and then everybody's going to come for me because I've said this now on the air. That's fine. But
we're going to clip this and pass it around,
you know,
on
what
social
I mean?
Media.
I just wouldn't rule out the moves. I mean, if you look at sports history, I mean, my mother was a Dodgers fan, but that's when they were in Brooklyn. They've been in L.A. my entire childhood. So, I mean, you know, teams move.
Sure.
You know? And so you just got to be wary of that. When they don't get what they want, they pick up. I mean, these are billion-dollar organizations.
So what we're saying is yesterday's vote in Indiana is paving the way for a stadium in Hammond. Is that what we think?
I'm hoping they stay in Illinois.
Because the proposal, I mean, it's pretty specific. It's got, you know, new food, beverage, and innkeeper's taxes in Indiana's northwest counties to help pay for this, right? To help pay for the infrastructure.
I mean, it sounds great. I mean, to the folks in the south suburbs, it's like, oh, it's just over the state line.
This would
be great.
Unlike moving the Dodgers, like, people in Chicago can still go down to Hammond and watch.
Brooklyn to LA.
Yeah.
Brooklyn to LA is different.
That's very different.
So this proposed site for the stadium, where is it exactly?
Wolf Lake.
Wolf Lake.
Yeah. So also another lakefront property. Is it as beautiful as being on Chicago's lakefront? I can't say.
But to our earlier point, kind of as close to Illinois as you can
it's
get.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Interesting that while the Indiana legislature was giving the Bears the green light, the Illinois legislature seemed to be giving them a red light. The Illinois House Committee canceled a meeting that could have brought the Bears a step closer to a new stadium here. Tell us more, Simone.
Yeah, I was a little, you know, it's interesting because like ahead of that meeting, we were like, okay, we're going to hear more about this new mega developments bill that would, the key issue in Arlington Heights right now is what the Bears want is they want a property tax assessment freeze, basically. We don't want to be paying skyrocketing property taxes as we increase the value of this property. And there was supposed to be a hearing on that this week. And then it was just sort of kind of canceled basically around the same time as the Hammond news was. It was like within hours of each other. Like it was kind of weird. So I don't know kind of where lawmakers' heads are at this point on that. But yeah. I hope we'll hear more about what that bill will be because it seems significant.
The ball is in the Bears' hands.
Yes.
And they're... I think playing these two states against each other.
Yes.
Yeah. As all this drama was going on, though, the Bears also announced that season ticket prices are going to go up 13.5%. I mean, it was a good season, Alden, but how do we think Bears fans are feeling about that right now?
I think Bears fans are still in their honeymoon with the team. I mean, in some level, Chicago's always been a Bears town. We've had moments when we were, you know, the Bulls town in the mid to late 80s or 90s. But the Bears are really kind of, they're just a part of the fabric of this city from a sports perspective. And I think the folks will always love the Bears, especially when they're winning. And right now, they're winning. Now, if they go five, you know, heaven forbid, they go 5-12 next season.
We hope not.
very specific there.
Then you will be hearing some grouching about how much it costs. But I mean, going to the Bears game already is a is you got to be in another tax bracket in order to afford that.
So if you're
doing it, then
you clip that. You can clip that instead.
But if they beat all over social media. But if they beat the Green Bay Packers the entire time, they'll be celebrated for the rest of their lives.
So is there ever a point then when you think fans might just get so fed up, they walk away from their tickets or just their support of the Chicago Bears?
Mm-mm. No.
Never. I don't think so, no.
Never.
No. And I think the Bears are going to take advantage of that.
We got some very sad news this week, folks. Chicagoans have been remembering, paying tribute to, honoring the Reverend Jesse Jackson all week. He died at the age of 84 on Tuesday morning, and his family announced that he's going to lie in state next Wednesday and Thursday at Rainbow Push headquarters. Then there will be a People's Celebration next Friday and homegoing services on the weekend at Rainbow Push. You interviewed some folks as well, Christian. I mean, you've kind of been on the beat this week.
Yeah, Alderman William Hall, who before becoming an alderman was his personal assistant and national field director as well. So he worked side by side with the Reverend for a number of years, I believe back in 2007, 2008. He was very emotional about this. He considered the Reverend Jackson to be like a second father to him, guided him, pushed him, took him around the world. He told me a story that he was initially offered a job by Reverend Jackson, and he said the money wasn't good enough. And the Reverend Jackson brought him back in, and he said, I've given you a little bit more. I can't give you any more than this, but I can give you an experience that you probably will not have anyplace else. Mm. And he took that on, and he said he's so happy that he did because it sort of planted the seed with the rest of his career that ended up in politics. And he was not a political person. He wasn't a part of the Young Democrats, is what he told me. And he gave him advice when he was running for alderman, and he said, you know, love the people, take care of them, and everything else will take care of itself.
Wow.
And sort of that's how he's lived. And this young man just had tears in his eyes when he talked about losing this person who was like a father to him. And I think a lot of people felt that way. You heard Jesse Jackson Jr. kind of get choked up talking about his father as well. He was there when he took his last breath and he told his mother, and his mother immediately got to the phone and started to tell the whole entire world that he had passed. And the whole entire world has responded to this because he's had so much impact, not just here in Chicago, but across the globe, not just the country.
That's right.
You know, he helped get hostages out. You know, he has worked with presidents.
Yeah.
He's protected voting rights up until the day of his death.
We talked yesterday on the program about what he's done for LGBTQ rights, right? He's also spoken out for Palestinian rights, apartheid. He was involved in a little of everything. He was just a global leader. We had interesting conversations this week on In the Loop. We talked with scholars. We talked with reverends. We talked with longtime journalists. I remember Madeline Ihijerica was on, and longtime Chicago journalist. She's now with the Field Foundation. But she talked about, and it was fascinating, you know, how he really was, he kind of took Black journalists under his wing, so to speak, and you know, would make sure that they were in the room, would make sure that they got the big story first and could take it back to their editor at a time when it was difficult to get things like that approved. We had Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun on the program, too, who had fond memories of working for him in the 1988 presidential election. What are some of your thoughts and reflections, Alden, about the Reverend?
The thing you mentioned, there were a number of instances where he, I was saying, even in the 70s, was pushing to have Black journalists get access, even within their own shops. You know, you need to increase your numbers here, so on and there. And I just remember the few instances where I had a chance to kind of be in his presence. I got the incredible honor to kind of host one segment of his annual convention. My boss at the time, Andy Shaw at the Better Government Association, was supposed to do it. He couldn't. He asked if I would fill in for him, so I did. And I got a chance to see, I got a chance to meet Oscar Robertson. The Reverend introduced me to him, the Big O.
And then times when I appeared on his broadcast, his weekly broadcast. There were a few instances where I got to be on there and got to engage with him and Jonathan, talking about issues affecting the city and the world. And just to be that close to a legend and to have him respond to what I was offering and to hear him up close and personal was something I'll always remember.
Yeah. Rest in peace, Reverend Jesse Jackson.
A true change agent. Yeah.
Now, did you all have a chance to this week enjoy that fake spring?
Of course.
Yeah.
Did you lean all the way in? Anybody wear shorts?
No. Sorry.
Didn't wear shorts.
No. But you mean I saw people wearing shorts.
I saw people wearing shorts. I saw some sandals.
You mean it's not spring yet?
No, this is fake. So Monday we broke a more than 100-year-old weather record for February 16th. Back in 1921, the temperature on that day made it up to 58 degrees. On Monday of this week, we made it to 65. So I can understand why all of you got excited. But those temperatures are coming back down. I wore my big coat all week. I don't know. I don't like to be teased.
You don't like to be teased in that way.
I'm with you on that one. And I saw the big coats out today. So
I mean, I was hot.
Yeah, it was hot.
And this is my first time admitting that out loud. I was hot. The big coat was not needed. It was a little extra.
But it's like a psychological thing. I get where you're coming from, Sasha. Like you don't want to get caught unawares. This feels like a scam. You're not going to get scammed today.
Right. You know, I was out, you know, getting a pedicure and manicure, and this lady was staring at me because I still had my coat on, and I thought she was just, you know, wanting to just smile and greet. And
was she wearing flip-flops or something?
She was, because she also got a pedicure. The pedicure flip-flops. But I think, you know, in hindsight, she was looking at me like, girl,
do you know what's happening?
I'm sorry. I'm with you. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Along with the high temperatures, though, we did have some high winds this week. Those high winds caused a near deadly tragedy on Wednesday. Now, the gust of wind, it actually blew a baby stroller with a baby in it into Belmont Harbor. 30-year-old Leo Cundiff heard a woman screaming, immediately jumped into the lake, and other Good Samaritans, too. They sprung into actions to help, to help Cundiff and the baby come back to safety. Now, good news, Cundiff, the baby, and the baby's mother were all hospitalized overnight, and all are in good condition. But wow, what a story, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so lucky.
A stroller being blown into the lake?
Oh my gosh, it's a worst nightmare, right? And especially because the lake is still quite cold right now.
It's very cold.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, it's cold as you get into the summer.
Yeah, which I would imagine is why they all had to be hospitalized, too. Yes. Right. That water was cold.
But it's great to have a happy ending with it. Because a lot of those times I've covered a lot of those stories, and it does not have the happy ending we had here.
Yeah, well, real quick before you go, and super quick, what are you working on next week? Christian.
We're starting to sort of ramp up going back into reparations. We're supposed to be getting a harms report from the state of Illinois. They have this commission. And, you know, how's that impacted with DEI being stripped away? So that's some of the discussions we're going to be having.
Alden?
We've got a series on the history of the Black church in Chicago, which starts next Thursday from Nicole Janine Johnson.
Nicole Johnson.
Looking forward to that.
Looking forward to that, too. And Simone?
We've also got a series on for Black History Month on some of the Black community's contributions to Chicago. Gospel music, roller skating, but also the Black Panthers.
Can't wait to hear that from Jacoby.
Good stuff.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.